AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 67 for August 12, 2010, The 30% Solution. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. And joining me in the studio, as always, every Thursday night, is the auto extremist himself in person. He's bequeathed his presence upon us again, Peter DeLorenzo. Great having you here, Peter.
I'm glad to be here, but, you know, I'm in a hurry because Ed and I are flying back to Texas tonight.
Ed Whitaker. Yeah. And that's one thing that we're going to be talking a lot about tonight, too. But also joining us here is Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics. Great having you back, Jim.
Random collection of cells with no opinion of its own.
I don't agree. And in fact, by the end of the show, everybody is going to be on my side, too. Later in the show, we're going to have Chris DeBoer, who's from a company called Transonic Combustion. They've got this breakthrough technology in fuel injection that they say can improve the fuel economy of an engine, some 30% or that. We'll be getting into that later. Before we get into the news, though, I want to remind everybody, next week, for the Dream Cruise, the Woodward Avenue Dream Cruise, we're doing a special show. It's going to be a great show. But we're going to do it on Wednesday, not Thursday. And we're doing it that, the reason for doing that, I should say, is we've got a great location called the Balmoral Center at Normandy and Woodward Avenue. That's like 13 and a half mile. And we're going to be doing the show from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. We're going to go longer, twice as long as we normally do. And remember, we went for this location because we got a lot of place to put cars. If you're in the Detroit area or if you're going to be here next Wednesday, let us know. We'd love to have you come by and bring your car. But if you're bringing a car to put on display, you have to register with us. Go to send us an email. Go to our email address, viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv. And if you don't have a special car, come on over anyway. We've got plenty of parking space. But anyway, folks, we'd love to see it then. But let's get to the news because, man, there was a bombshell today. Ed Whitaker announcing that he's going to step down as CEO of General Motors at the end of this month and then step down as chairman of General Motors at the end of the year. But Peter, we all knew that he wasn't going to be here very long.
Yeah, he made it. He made no bones about the fact that he was an interim guy. And, you know, it was surprising, but it wasn't. And he's going to be chairman at the end of the year, so he's going to ride the IPO out. And, you know,
that's a good point, because I had other people say, oh, I thought he'd stay until the IPO, but that's a great point. He will be here for the IPO.
Yeah. So, and he made no bones about the fact that I'm not moving here. I like it in Texas, and so, you know.
But plus the IPO, you have to understand some things about the IPO. When you do an IPO, you want to have management in place that looks like it's going to be there for the period that the investors are going to be interested in entertaining. So, and if he's a short timer in that respect, we said, you know, this is to get it started. You were going to have another CEO in there. It was going to happen. The CEO also is the guy that has to functionally go and run this thing around the dog and pony show, because he has to sell the IPO to the big investment houses, to the institutional investors.
And this guy, Dan Ackerson,
he's an investment banker. He's born to do it.
Or at least now he's an investment banker.
Right. And the point is that he's been not a completely hands-off board member either. So he understands the organization. You can then have him go out and say, look, I'm going to be here for 3 years. He's 61. So if they do the 65 and out, he's got 4 years in, which is going to make most investors pretty happy about stability in the organization. Because if you think of a car company as a series of houses and getting them in order, GM's got the product house predominantly in order. They really do. They've got a good handle on engineering. They have a good handle on design. Product planning is getting hammered down to where it needs to be. Manufacturing, they're pretty damn good.
They're very competitive.
So you look at those parts, that's handled. Marketing is the open one. They have some new people in there. Marketing is the next battlefield. That's the one where I'm not completely convinced. They've got to actually show that they can do it. But the other issue is...
a good guy to do that.
They did, absolutely.
They went out and bought the talent, Joel Iwanek.
Right, but the point is that now they've got to validate that. The only open part was General Motors Financial. GM got in the position it was in because of the way they ran the financial side of the business. So here they've got somebody that's going to be talking about the IPO, that's going to make investors hopefully happy. The big issue with the IPO is, one, everybody's realistic enough to understand there will not be an IPO as an only public offering. They will not get $60 billion this go around. There's not enough money out there chasing down opportunities.
But they don't need $60 billion right now.
Right, I know that.
Yeah.
No.
They just got to get the government Motors monkey off their back, and if they get to 49% ownership
theoretically,
the government,
right,
that would help.
It would help. But the point is that's a staged thing. So you look at it and you say, one, Ed did a lot of work to change the culture for the people that are still there. I mean, it wasn't the same old GM. And
I'm not convinced. I'm convinced when you get outside of the core part of the business, mm-hmm. but the design, engineering, manufacturing, sales, service, purchasing, I'm not yet convinced that it's changed that much.
I am, but for another reason. It has to do with who's not there anymore and how they don't do stuff they used to do. But an autoimmune system's colossally powerful. The old way may find its way back in there pretty easily. And it's the death of a thousand cuts. It happens a little bit. It's like, oh, yeah, we're more comfortable.
But, Peter, what do you think of this guy, Ackerson, who's going to be there? I think as a chairman, he's probably the right guy for all the reasons that Jim just said.
CEO.
Okay, but that's where I'm getting
to. But he's going to be
my
chairman.
Question.
I know that.
In January 1.
Right.
In January 1. But is he going to be CEO, too? You know, and the reason I say that is I just heard some management consultant guy say, if you got a CEO who really doesn't know the business that you're in, really can't talk about the products that you've got and the customers that you got and the suppliers that you use, you need a new CEO.
But, John, you just described Roger Smith, Tom Murphy, Doner. You want me to keep going back?
But they were chairmen, not CEOs.
They were both.
Okay. Well,
they were both because the GM
then it
position
explains why GM got
right.
in the position
See,
it's in.
The historic position for GM was that it was chairman and CEO, president and COO. They clustered those jobs together.
Well, no, if you even go back farther, the term CEO ever came into existence, it was chairman and president.
Right.
Chairman was always a finance guy.
Yep.
The CEO or the president.
The president was with the Ed Coles.
Operations.
Was the Ed Cole, you know, when Ed Cole was, he was president.
And he was an engineer, a working engineer.
Right.
Absolutely.
So the question is Ackerson the right guy to be CEO of the company?
He's a financial guy.
He's a financial guy.
He's a guy, in my opinion.
Yeah.
CEO.
GM's success will not hinge on that. Yes, he will get the financial part in order, but GM's success will hinge on the Mark Royces and the
Absolutely
Ed Welburns
correct.
Of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could... And as long as Ackerson...
But can the Royces and the Welburns be as effective as they've got to be with a CEO who doesn't understand the business?
Well,
theoretically, yes.
Mark Royce be the CEO?
Well,
that's a whole other issue.
I know, and he's young, and he's got to grow into the position.
Yeah, don't be surprised.
So maybe in 4 years, how old is he then?
And he'll be about 50.
Don't be surprised.
Pretty young guy.
He'll be in his mid-50s, I think.
I would not be shocked.
Now?
Maybe
47.
Yeah.
Okay. I would be shocked if Mark didn't end up being CEO.
It's I'd love to see him get it. I think.
But he needs some more time in there. And the problem they have now is a big one. You know, the whole issue with the IPO is, are they going to do the IPO as a traditional IPO where the stock is basically given to a bunch of investment houses and institutional investors? They buy it directly and then they resell it. In the case of investment houses, is it going to be an open IPO where anybody can buy the stock, or a hybrid, which is where you do a bit of both? And arguably, the open IPO would be the far more interesting one because it would get them a lot more cash in faster. But
and it'd be politically correct.
Absolutely correct. But it is also the toughest one for the street to feel comfortable with. They're always uncomfortable because remember,
they're uncomfortable because they wouldn't get the fees.
Exactly. But that's my point. Therein lies one of the flaws of the whole system that we have that uses stock valuation from firms on Wall Street that's jobs are to sell the stocks. And so the valuation is based on the trading price, not whether or not it cuts a dividend or not. That's, I mean, that's the big deal now with Apple. Apple's got all this cash, and major investment firms wrote a letter and said, you need to pay some of this out.
Well, you know, there is a good historical connection in that, too. When General Motors was first formed, this goes back to, I think it was...
First General Motors.
Not the first General
Motors. Not William C. Durant General Motors, Sloan General Motors.
No, I'm talking about Durant General
Motors. Okay, that's first General Motors.
When he was trying to get the stock price up, he issued, and I want to say this was in 1918, they did a $50 dividend.
Right.
Now, even today, that would be a massively big dividend. So imagine it in 1918 dollars. And sure enough, the stock price shot through the roof, and he was able to go out and buy whatever he wanted using the stock.
What would that be in today's stock?
I don't know.
Oh, Lord.
$5,000? I don't know.
Let me see here. It'd be below 5,000, but over 3,500, I think. It's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
And the point is, he could do that because he didn't have that many shares outstanding. He was trying to move shares too. Mm-hmm. That was also as an issuance and to get the price up. So it was a wonderful way to do it.
Well, you know, the cool thing about the history of this business is, I grew up and I was born in Flint, and all that history of the Flint. All the business was done in the back room of the Flint City Club.
Really?
Which my dad belonged to. And the legacy of Durant was alive and well. I mean, that's where the business was done, right up through the 50s of General Motors.
Well, didn't Durant take over Buick first and then use that as the stepping stone to build GM? So, yeah, GM's roots really go back to Flint.
Yeah, well, it's all Flint. And then the Flint City Club was the
center of
quintessential
everything.
Cigar smoke back room.
That's, heavy wood paneling.
That's where it all happened. It's cool.
What did you guys make of GM's earnings?
Hey, think about it. You know, they've got product. They're doing. They have pretty good labor situation. They have a lot of costs hammered down. They're going to make some money. And even though they did have the highest incentives of the major four, you know, $4,000+ per car.
I think it's impressive, but it also points to the fact of just how impressive Ford's numbers were.
Yeah,
you're right.
Right. No question about it. And not just Ford's. Honda had a great quarter, too. They even reported higher profits than Ford.
Yeah, but Honda's lost their mojo. That's a whole other story.
Yeah, that is. I know we've been on that.
The more Honda does well financially, the more they're going to think that's all they got to chase rather than getting their cars right again. And that's absolutely wrong.
And they need to get their cars right again.
The one thing that I found digging into the earnings report that shocked me was in the last quarter, GM... In the United States, in passenger cars, 42.5%, I think that's right, if I'm quoting it right, fleet sales. And everyone's been jumping on Chrysler for fleet sales, but damn near half of every car, pass car, now I'm not including trucks, went to fleets.
Remember, John, fleet isn't necessarily evil.
I know, you're preaching to the choir here.
I know, and the thing is,
but I was
shocked. It's quasi-evil.
No, it depends on how you manage it. If you're doing fleet deals, we've got guaranteed buybacks at a set number. You need your head examined. If you're selling vehicles to large purchasers and you're managing it as a fleet business should be managed, it's a critical part of the business. And it's actually one that, if you do it right, is very good for volume leveling and forecasting, and it can get you some money.
Yeah. Oh, I agree totally. I was just shocked
that it was that high.
42%. 42% is a big number. So I was surprised in that.
Understand what part of that is. Part of that were fleet orders that normally would have been processed earlier in the year, but with the bankruptcy and the companies held off buying. There was a lot of that, actually.
Well, I don't know, because Chrysler seemed to have sold a lot of fleet sales in the first quarter. So
the same mechanism was happening there. These companies, were they going to go bankrupt or weren't they? What was going to happen? And a lot of fleet purchasers that had contracts said, we're going to hold off. That was especially the case in Chrysler. And then as the thing stabilized, they started taking delivery on vehicles. They got Ram heavy-duty production up. So that helped because there was some heavy-duty fleet stuff in there, tow truck operators and so on. So it's one of those things. You have to understand that mechanism is going to make them look flush for a while, where Ford is far more level. Ford didn't have that backup the way these other guys did, where companies just said, nope, sorry, we're going to hold off.
Right. So, well, you know, Ford's just balanced all the way around because every business unit in the company, i.e. Europe, Latin America, Asia Pacific, North America, et cetera, everything's profitable. Mm-hmm. GM's still losing money in Europe.
Yep.
It just got a finance arm, so it's got to gear that whole thing up. But, you know, to your point, the future looks bright.
Yeah,
because if you can make these kinds of profits at abysmally low sales levels.
Well, the revolving credit deal they cut was critically important to General Motors. They couldn't even, if they weren't able to pull that off, the whole idea of an IPO would have been really distasteful to a lot of people that understand the business. They would have said, no, forget it. So that was a big deal.
Another thing that jumped out at me when you dig down into the earnings report, we all know now, because GM's been saying it for a while, that it sells more cars outside of the United States than in the United States. Well, I did the numbers. 72% of their sales are outside of the United States.
And what, 99% of their profitability?
Well, actually, 78% of their profitability is in North
Asia.
America. No. It's North America.
That Europe is now profitable because of the labor deal. And the other problem is, Peter, when you think about it, that Europe is such a burden on them.
But what about Asia? Asia's
good.
Asia was really good.
Remember, in China, for example, you don't see all that profit.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, you're cutting it with Shanghai.
Well, the government's saying, three for us.
Well, you're selling little Wuling vans at $5,000. The margins on that isn't much at all.
But you're splitting the margin. Also.
Well, you're splitting it, but, you know, the point is that 72% of the sales are outside of the United States. 78% of the profits are in North America. Right. I can't say what it is for the U.S. because they don't break that out, but, you know, it's overwhelmingly in the U.S.
Mexico could actually be pretty profitable for them, too.
And Canada, actually.
So what are all these car companies going to do when there's a regime change in China and all of a sudden they say, you know,
all the foreigners leave.
Yeah, we're taking
foreign friends. Thank you. We thank you for all you've helped, the help you've given us. It actually happened, I believe, to a GM division. It was one of the early things that was building S pickup trucks where they didn't even have a railhead to get parts to the plant. It was one of those make work programs. It was sort of like on a mountain or something. And they had suppliers that had come in to provide them with stuff that were joint ventures with Michigan suppliers. And sometimes these guys would come in and find out, oh, my God. I'm sorry.
that was his telephone, folks, so if you wondered why there was an interruption. Anyway.
They basically, some of these guys came in and they said, we want to thank our foreign friends. You've helped us a lot, but we'll be running the plant now.
Bye-bye now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
what's the recourse?
There is no recourse, right. No. I mean, you know, look, you got to be in China. There's no question about it. But, man, I still think there is a bubble building in the Chinese economy. I think when the bubble bursts and the Civil War breaks out, we're going to all scratch our heads and say, why did we think this was just going to go on forever?
I wrote an editorial years ago that said if you had your choice of going into China or India, you should do India. They both require joint ventures for similar historic cultural reasons. But in India, you have basically English rule of law. You really do. And you know you're open,
and,
of course.
And they speak English.
They speak English. you know, so, and they had the same issues. The automotive infrastructure in India, when you get out of the cities, is non-existent. So they had to build it, but the Chinese committed to building it. I mean, the Chinese road building has been absolutely astonishing.
All of China has been astonishing.
Yeah.
The growth there has been amazing, and everyone's talked about India, but...
Well, it's a classic, the road to nowhere. They're just building roads.
And they
just,
are, right.
Just keep on building them.
Right.
Look at that bridge.
Well, you know, that's what I've always said about China. I love Winston Churchill because he's always got these great sayings, and one of my favorite quotes of his is that democracy is the worst form of government there is, except compared to all the others. And that's a problem that they're facing in China is that, you know, if they want to get something done, they just go do it.
Right.
There's no environmental impact statement. There's no, you know, get the people on board. It's just go ahead and do it. And I just think that they're going to be building a lot of stresses in their society where other voices that are not being taken into account as decisions get made in the country at some point are just going to rise up and say, no, you got to listen to us. And in a democracy, you know, we all can get together, we can write articles, we can form political parties, we can have marches or whatever it is. You can't do that in China. And so the pressure contained and builds.
Culturally, you have to remember, China's the country that invented bureaucracy. They had a huge bureaucracy in place it might have been 1,000 BC or maybe 2,000 BC for irrigation of the Yalu River. It was an irrigation. It was a water thing. It was a gigantic bureaucracy. And people had their position in the bureaucracy, and that's what they did. I mean, there's a historic thing about organization in China that's always been very impressive.
Ladies and gentlemen, the man who knows too much.
Sorry.
No, it's good.
Burke told me this.
I love it.
Fascinated.
Oh, I met James Burke.
Yeah, I love it, Jim.
Yeah, it was a fascinating discussion.
I say that affectionately, Jim.
I know. But it's like, damn, I don't know too much. I want to know more.
Hey, another thing that broke this week. all this report of sudden unintended acceleration with Toyota's now, NHTSA's really digging down deep into it, NASA's into it, the National Academy of Sciences into it, and they're all going, hey, these people didn't have their foot on the brake.
Yep. What a surprise.
God, that's just unbelievable.
I mean, my favorite is you have the Scion TC had exactly the same powertrain as the Camry had for a lot of the for many of the years, identical. And the incidence of Scion TC unintended accelerations, zero. Now, higher percentage of manual transmissions, no unintended acceleration with manual transmissions, and the ones that had automatics, no unintended acceleration. Younger, nervous buyers who are paying attention more than somebody who's just, I mean, the boomers. This is only going to get worse as we get older. You know that. We're going to hear more and more of this.
Yeah,
right. Well, the other thing, you know, that's got to be pointed out is virtually every brand suffers from the problem of unintended acceleration. But this is the interesting thing is it only seems to happen in the United States. You just don't hear any reports about this elsewhere.
Sorry. You have to understand, there's something about the United States. It's actually in the Constitution. In the original. It's not in any of
the... the man who knew too much. Now he's making it up.
No, I assure you, this is absolutely true. Think about it. We apparently have a constitutional right to drive an automobile regardless of whether or not we know how. Okay? And if we have a problem in the car, it's a constitutional right to blame somebody else.
No, sue somebody else.
Before it was blamed, there weren't that many lawyers. Now we have so many lawyers, of course you'd sue. You know, if you think about this, lawyers are a cash crop. We should be exporting overseas.
Yes, right.
I know, as a matter of fact, that in Somalia, there are not enough trial attorneys.
Oh, well, look, our trial attorneys, plaintiff attorneys, are far more lethal than our armed forces.
Oh, wow. You know, think about this. Employee lawyers against the Taliban.
Well, the Taliban laughed, and now we've been shutting down all their bank accounts because the lawyers have been going after that.
Yeah.
So, another thing we got to mention, I don't know how well you guys knew Jerry Flint, journalist who passed away just about a week ago. And, boy, Jerry was not just a curmudgeon. He was a character. And but actually, I would say of all the automotive journalists I have met in my career, probably the best. Not necessarily the most friendly, but that guy had more insight than anybody. I'm going to miss him. He taught me a lot, and not that he sat down and taught me. Jerry didn't have the time of day to do anything like that with me, but just watching him in action, that guy was impressive.
I was at a press function, and he was there. He just made a comment to one of the PR people from the car community and says, you know, you guys don't believe me because I'm basically just sort of old and stupid. And the PR person said, well, maybe one out of two. And this is like 5 years ago. So Jerry was getting up there in years. But there was nothing about which Jerry did not have an opinion.
That's right.
And sometimes highly, irrational, but always entertaining.
Always entertaining. I love being around the guy in small doses. I don't know if I could have taken it all the time, but he had an incredible knack of getting under the skin of top-level executives.
Oh, yeah.
He would get them so pissed off, they'd actually blurt out the truth.
Yep.
And I remember when Ford was launching the Mondeo. Remember, that was a $6 billion program. All new platforms, all new engines, all new transmissions,
remember,
all new plants, all new everything.
It's not just Mondeo. It was Mondeo, Detour, and the Mistake. Okay, so it was the whole family.
It was the whole family.
Yeah, I was behind one coming down here today.
And there was a guy at Ford at the time named Lou Ross, and he was out giving us all the company propaganda of how good this was all going to be, and Jerry started throwing questions at him, just lobbing them at him. And I was sitting in a row with Daron Levine, who I think was at the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal at the time, and Lou Ross just kept getting more and more angry at what Jerry was asking him about until he finally blurted out, we're never going to make any money on this car.
Yeah. You know, and that's it. Guess what?
And Daron and I turned around, our jaws on our chests, just in awe that Jerry was able to get this top-level executive at Ford to spill his guts that, yeah, we're never, ever going to make any money on this thing.
He knew how to push buttons to get a reaction that was going to get more than the guys were ever going to say. He was almost like he was the antidote to media training.
Right. He really was. Hey, and one other topic that I find very interesting, because we've heard Toyota and Honda complaining vociferously about this right now, of how strong the yen is getting against the dollar, to the point where they're saying it no longer makes any sense to export small cars out of Japan. They cannot do it profitably. Right. This has got to be a disaster for them.
Yeah. And I say, boo frickin' who. They've been manipulating it. The Japanese government has been in cahoots with the Japanese car manufacturers and the yen for decades. And now, all of a sudden, they, you know.
What's interesting, though, when they have had a high-value yen, they haven't really complained about it until now.
Yeah, now it's.
Now they complained about it. Now, it's never been at this level.
Oh, no. I remember them. If you go back to around 1990 when the bubble burst and the bubble economy there.
I don't remember them complaining about it.
Oh, I do.
Said we have to work around it.
No, I remember that. Oh, like, well, no, that's a good point. Jim.
Yeah, that's
good
a good point.
Right.
And the thing is, the guys that complained about the value of the yen all the time were usually guys like Rick Wagner. And they would complain about the value. The guys would go, oh, we just got to deal with it. Now, this time, they're complaining about it, which is unprecedented. But it's never been at this level. Absolutely astonishing.
No, and you say Rick Wagner. I'll even go back earlier than that. I remember when Red Poling was the chairman of Ford and bitching about it being at 220 to the dollar.
Right, exactly.
You know, he must be. I don't know if is Red still with us these days or not. I haven't seen him in years.
Well,
but
he's in our thoughts.
He's in our thoughts. But man, he must be fist pump in the air here at what is it now? 85 yen to the dollar.
Yeah.
What's going to happen here? I mean, this is a disaster that I don't think they can quickly fix in any way, shape, or form. Except get production out of Japan.
Get production out of Japan. Or you got to understand, in a lot of cases, in Toyota or Honda's case, it's not the truth. But in Toyota's case, the Yaris is good volume, but it's not that high volume. That's their outsourced small car, essentially. It really is. The XA and the XD and the XB are cars that are not produced by Toyota. They're produced by Daihatsu, and I think one of the other ones, Central Motor, for Toyota. And with those cars, they carry a price premium for their content. I mean, if you think about it, a Yaris and a Scion XD are the same car, and they don't sell for the same price. So they have some pricing headroom on those cars, but it's not a position you want to be in. And I've never understood, in a lot of cases, why, when you get a currency that gets out of whack, why you continue to import the most price-sensitive vehicles from the unfavorable currency. I've never understood it.
Well, because that was part of Japan Inc., and it's an export machine that's worked brilliantly well since about 1960.
But the cars you build, you tend to build cars by volume base in a country where you're in. So you go for the cars that were the highest volume, and you're saving money then on things like outbound freight. But you got to have an engine plan. And as all these guys know, when they first started up, before they got the engine plants going, there were false economies in building cars in this country. And if you think about it, you look at the range of Toyota's products and Honda's, the engines they build here are not the engines that go in those cars.
So what's going to happen? Are they going to move more production to the United States, where they still make most of their profits? Toyota, Honda, and Nissan still make most of their profits in the United States. Do you move more production here, or do you move it to Thailand, China, Mexico, and then import it?
Personally, I think it depends on the company. But in the case of Toyota, I wouldn't be surprised to see them move production to Mexico for Yaris, take Yaris down into Mexico. Because Nissan's building small cars down there already. They understand how that's manageable. But it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Toyota do Mexico. And then that would leave Honda to pursue if they wanted to. Honda might pursue Thailand or Southeast Asia somewhere.
Hey, let's bring our guest on for the show. Chris, come on. Come on up here with us on the set. We've got Chris DeBoer here.
Like the Boer Wars.
Like the Boer Wars. Exactly right. And you are the head of research and development for Transonic. Is that right?
That's right.
And what, vice president, or what do we just call you? The head of R&D?
Or just the head of R&D. You'll be fine.
Let Chip put the microphone on you there. And Ike can inspect it.
Chip, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chip Drake.
Mr. Chip Drake, putting on the microphone. So, Chris, as I've talked about before on the show, I'm sure Jim and Peter find the same thing. We get bombarded with people who are saying, I've just invented the next thing that's going to save the industry. And, you know, most of that ends up in my wastebasket or my, you know, garbage on my laptop. But when I see that a company has got Bob Lutz on the board of directors and Don Runkel on the board of directors and Vinod Khosla on the board of directors, that's when I sit up and go, oh, here's a company I ought to look a little bit more into. And then I see that you've got this new fuel injection system that, if I've got it right, you're claiming you can get a 30% improvement in fuel economy. Start talking. Tell us about this thing. What's going on at this company?
Well, it is indeed a breakthrough technology. It's not just another fuel injection system. It's a fuel injection system that actually, before we inject the fuel, we raise the temperature and pressure of the fuel into what's known as a supercritical fluid. And I won't go into the science of that right now, but it effectively allows...
Step back a sec. How do you heat it up? How do you pressurize it?
Quite conventionally. We have a fuel pump that produces the pressure, and we have we use predominantly waste exhaust gas.
So it's an air-to-air heat exchanger, basically?
Effectively. Okay. It's a gas-to-liquid heat exchanger.
I'm saying you're actually using a heating liquid to heat the fuel up then?
No, we're heating using the exhaust gas to heat the fluid. And when you reach certain temperatures and pressures, you transform the fuel from basically a liquid state through a gas state into a supercritical state. It's actually the fourth state of matter. And this has some very unique properties, which when you administer the fuel in this way into an engine, we get a very fast combustion. And we can run at very lean limits. So the combination of the improvement in combustion, the combination of eliminating the throttle of an engine, combined with increases in compression ratio, really transform the combustion process, and not through our own measurements, but through independent measurements, we have shown that compared to today's gasoline engines, we get 25% improvement in thermal efficiency.
Okay, 25%. I've been saying 30%.
Well, when I say...
Maybe I should be your cheerleader.
Well, there's lots of ways of measuring this. You can measure specific efficiencies on an engine, on a test bed. That's one thing, and you'll get one number. You can do that at different speeds and loads, and you'll get a whole different series of numbers. You can then put the engine in a vehicle, and you'll get yet another number. And so the conservative estimates are 25% to 35% fuel efficiency.
You didn't have a throttle, so are you using fuel introduction for speed change?
That's right.
Okay.
It's acting like a diesel.
It's acting very much like a diesel. In fact, the efficiencies are very close to a diesel engine.
Do you run traditional auto cycle combustion or compression ratios? Or can you use a lower compression ratio doing this?
No, we can actually increase
it without knock. Okay.
Without knock, yes. And we don't have knock because we're introducing the fuel at a late stage in the compression.
And it burns
so completely.
And it burns really quickly.
I was going to say that the supercritical state is actually allowing it to burn much faster. It's more of a constant speed at any pressure, right?
It's more like an ideal cycle, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the typical compression ratio? Is it?
We're probably looking at around 15 to 1.
Wow.
Whoa. I was thinking 12.5, 13.
<That right. laughs>
No, well, we might end up 12.5, 13. But right now, let's say I would like it to be around 14. Mm-hmm. And that's, if you read all the textbooks, that's pretty much wherever we'd like to run their engine because it's close to the ideal efficiency.
And can you manage NOx? Because normally, higher compression ratio, higher temperature gives you more NOx. Can you manage NOx without having to use an SCR or a NOx reduction catalyst?
The initial indications are that we have a pretty good ability to control NOx.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're able to meet all the emission standards, is what Jim is getting at. At the same time, you're able to improve the fuel economy.
Well, I wouldn't say we're right there now, but we certainly have that target in view, and we have a number of mechanisms in place that enables us to.
So are the major manufacturers interested?
They are indeed, yes. We are already working with a number of major manufacturers. In fact, we're working with manufacturers in three continents, so in Asia, in Europe, and in North America.
Hmm. Who came up with this idea?
It's a chap called Mike Cheeky. He registered the initial patents and developed the initial laboratory tests and demonstrations of the technology and applied it to an engine, and actually went as far as putting this engine in a car and achieved 100 miles per gallon at 50 miles an hour. So
that got everyone's attention.
That got a few people's attention and clearly pleased our investors. And
how long ago was this when this first?
Well, the company's been around, was founded about 4 years ago. We've been working steadily, growing the team. We're about 40 people now. And we're
That's a pretty good-sized group, 40
yes,
people.
It's a very... very talented group, very diverse group, sort of thing you find in California. We're not all a bunch of motorheads.
Now, California, your accent to me doesn't sound California.
That's right. I'm a long way from the UK, which is where I came from.
How'd you end up there?
I've been working in engines for all of my life, and I work for a company called Ricardo. And
you know Ricardo.
Yeah.
They've only been around 100 years.
They've only been around about 100 years, and I spent about 25 years with them, and it was that company that brought me to North America.
And as I mentioned before, you know, people like Bob Lutz, Don Runkle, Vinod Khosla, how'd you get them on board?
Well,
or showed them the hardware, it sounds like.
I think, as you say, there are many technologies that come to the foreground, and you look at them and go, no, that's in the trash can. This one's been around long enough. We've got enough data. We have designs. We have experimental information. And when Bob Lutz took a look at it, he just went, wow. You know, I need to be part of that action. And here he is, and Don Runkle's the same. This isn't a 10-minute wonder. It's a breakthrough technology. You know, as I said, I've been in engines for 25 years, and you know, you see, you know, what percent here, percent there. This is just a bump in the road. This is like, whoa, 15, 20, 25%, and it's real.
I'm enough of a car junkie, though. There's a metric you haven't talked about, and fuel economy is wonderful, and we all care about it because that's what you need to have to get your cars to sell. What happens with horsepower and torque for any given displacement compared to an auto cycle engine of similar configuration?
Well, to run this engine effectively, as we've mentioned, it's similar to a diesel engine.
Yeah.
And the similarities continue, go through into the
diesel outputs, like braking
diesel outputs,
and so on.
And you know, the fact we used turbocharging technology to boost the air. So, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to be, well, how much boost do you want to apply as to how much power you want to get
okay.
out? And then there will be some thermal limitations, but
yeah.
But you're talking the about potentials.
It's there for comparable, but you're still talking about a reduction compared to a turbocharged auto cycle engine, like a Volkswagen 2-liter turbo, which is what, they got a 240 horsepower version.
Mm-hmm.
But the fuel consumption, it's using fuel like you would use to make a 2-liter do that. You could do it with less fuel, but you'd be doing less power, do you think?
I'm probably not going to reach 240 horsepower
out of
2 liters, but I think something like 200 horsepower. Mm-hmm.
So still in the hunt, yeah.
It's definitely
And
doable.
Cost. That's the other thing that we haven't talked about. What kind of cost would this add to an engine?
Well, we've done some initial cost estimates, and we think the fuel system, which looks very similar to either current gasoline direct injection system or diesel direct injection system. There are some fundamental differences there, but we think the marginal system cost will be about $1,000.
So, in other words, far less than what a diesel would cost.
A full diesel, because you're not getting into the crank and block and all that stuff.
But, and SER, you know, the emissions reduction for diesels, far less than a hybrid, a strong hybrid, obviously. Sounds pretty promising.
Yeah, and if you know, look at, let's say, 25% improvement in efficiency and mileage, and you're spending $1,000, well, the cost per percent is very attractive.
Try to do it with mass reduction.
So you mentioned that there's automakers on three continents interested. How many automakers in total do you have contracts now who are testing this?
We're working with four different automakers.
And it's still in development, so you don't have any production contracts, I would imagine.
No. And we don't anticipate this hitting production contracts in in vehicles, in engines, in vehicles until about 2015.
So it's a little bit out there, 5 years out there.
It's an in-development project.
And we have to complete our own development process first, and then there's the application engineering into the OE engines.
So you mentioned the guy who invented it. What's his name?
Mike Cheeky.
Mike Cheeky. Already put it in a car. Do you have it running in cars right now?
We had one demonstration vehicle, and really, you know, that was a demonstration. We're now much more involved in the engineering and the science and refining the concept.
What vehicle was your demonstration vehicle?
Well, it was in a vehicle that's equivalent to a Toyota Prius.
Well, the equivalent to the Toyota Prius is the Prius.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we solved that one.
Yeah. Now, the Prius, because of the nature of it, is a car that could benefit from an engine that has, theoretically, a lower operating RPM range. And Diesels have a tendency not to rev as high as autocycle engines. Where do you guys go in that? Are you an engine that likes running at a sweet spot more than constant up and down throttling? And also, is there a rev limit on this as there is in a diesel?
There will be, yes. Mm-hmm. I think the engine speed range is likely to be similar to
a diesel. And you'd mentioned that horsepower is down, but is torque, because the torque out of a diesel is what's so amazing about the engines. Where do you stand on torque output?
We're going to be having a characteristic similar to a diesel engine.
So in a way, what you have is a low-cost gasoline-fueled diesel, in a way.
What we have actually is a lower-cost engine that's running gasoline, but with a diesel efficiency.
Mm-hmm. And is it in any way, shape, or form compression ignition?
It is ultimately compression ignition.
Oh, okay. Really? Ultimately, what do you mean? Start it with spark plugs and then go compression?
Actually, this engine, we've already demonstrated cold start down to well below sub-zero temperatures.
With compression ignition?
With compression ignition without any heater plugs.
How do you get it heated if you're using the exhaust to heat this stuff in the first place? You have a little thermos bottle.
To augment the heat using electric power.
The advantage of a big battery pack. Heats fast and fast and hot. I mean,
very interesting. Mm-hmm. So when you say 2015 or so is when it's going to be ready, would that be ready for production? I mean, might we see it in showrooms if everything went perfectly well by then?
Yeah, if everything goes to plan. I mean, our injector system will be ready before then, but we need to work with the OEs to do the application work.
Sure, because it's going to take at least 3 years to get it into a program once they hit the green light.
So, 2015.
So you're very close. I mean, that means that they've got to nail this thing down by 2012 or so.
Conversely, it's a technology that doesn't necessitate tearing an engine completely up. They could take an existing engine and work with that as a starting point as far as bore centers, bore stroke relationship, and so on. They have to do new cranks because diesels require pretty beefy cranks.
Yeah. No, the system, you make a good point, it has a common architecture to current fuel injection system. So as far as the engine concerned, yes, we need to have an engine structure that can support the compression ratio and the power density and the torque density. But beyond that, it's fairly transparent, and it's not a major tear-up to production lines. You know, we're not arranging the cylinders in some funny manner and all that kind of stuff.
It builds like a regular engine.
Exactly the same as a regular engine, yeah.
I imagine that the EPA and the California Air Resources Board are highly interested in this because in the post-2015 world, they want to put the regulations in place to bump CAFE, corporate average fuel economy, up to 50 miles per gallon.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
and so you talk with them.
We are absolutely in the right space, in the right time, and this could be a very significant.
And you've met with them, the CARB and the EPA, or they visited your facilities or whatever?
Not yet, but we are talking to various government agencies, and yes, there is a lot of interest.
Well, that is fascinating. But let's wrap up this part of the show. And Ben, let's bring up the graphic. It's time for rapid fire.
Oh, I always like this.
Okay, Andre wrote in and he says, Peter, they're honoring Dan Gurney at this year's Monterey Historics. Which driver or mark would you have honored at next year's race?
I don't know. I'm still wallowing in Dan Gurney. I think that's such a great thing. He's one of my all-time heroes. Next year, boy, I don't know.
Be hard to top Dan Gurney.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I'm always up for Jim Hall, but they just did Jim a few
years. Not the Jim Hall sitting
here.
No.
Yeah. Jim, man, a few words, Hall. He's a hell of a good guy.
Yeah.
They just did a few years.
They did, yeah.
So we're running out of heroes. I mean,
It doesn't have to be a Yank.
Yeah.
The truth is, I still would say Stewart.
Jackie Stewart.
I really would.
I agree. Know, that guy did so much for the sport.
He did a lot for the sport. He did a lot for Formula One and actually organizing it at a driver level. I really think he's one of those guys. He's the one
who turned it into a money sport.
Absolutely correct.
Although that may not be a good thing.
Well, it goes both ways.
His the drivers are safety.
Yeah.
And driver safety. That's what I was going to say.
That's the guy.
I think he was out there.
But maybe Stewart could be pretty good. You get some good cars out for the track, too.
Yeah. Okay. Ben's running the graphic here that says, you've talked too long. Okay. Porsche Girl says, rapid fire comment. At Jim, saw you on Channel 7 News today at 8 Mile and Hagerty and Novi. Looking good.
Okay. I confess. I guess I did look good. I'm sorry. Thank you, Porsche girl. I'd love to know what kind of Porsche you have or want.
Comment from Ford guy. What do you think about Bill Ford taking $15 million pay retroactively now that Ford's making a profit? Ford just upset the unions. Now they want their retroactive part.
You know, what's the problem? I mean, Ford's starting to go forward, and he deserves to get paid. I mean, I don't understand what the issue is, really.
I don't think there's a problem. You know, Bill Ford has worked for a buck a year for, I don't know, a number of years.
A long time.
And, you know, he had the smarts to say, you know, I'm not smart enough. Let's go find somebody who is. Yeah. Got Alan Mulally in.
He deserves to be paid.
But he makes it, Ford guy makes a good point.
About
the unions are upset and now they want to walk there.
Yeah, understandable.
But they're going to be upset no matter what.
Well, the only thing I would say is I hope this town gets religion. And I hope the union gets religion, too, in this sense. Don't ask for all kinds of more benefits and more holidays and jobs banks and this. Go for profit sharing. If there's lots of profits, everybody should share.
Yep.
If there's no profits, eat beans.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, profit sharing would be great. It would be absolutely great.
Question for Jim Hall. How much did you cry when you heard of that guy in Texas that totaled his Bugatti Veyron in a lake?
A lot. It's one of my favorite cars. They just did this new orange and black special edition Veyron with a different bodywork. My God, I want that car.
Well, that was on video.
I mean, it was on the guy going to lake. Yeah,
YouTube.
It was
driver distraction, right?
There you go. Yeah.
Was he texting? That's the question.
No, didn't he say a buzzard?
It was a buzzard. Yeah,
it actually hit
the car, didn't it? Yeah.
Right. And I'm not sure it was Texas. I think it might have been like Louisiana.
No, it was Texas.
It was Texas? Okay. Joseph says, following on Peter's column this week, I agree the new Grand Cherokee is spectacular, but is it simply stealing sales from other Jeeps, especially the higher-priced Commander? If so, that doesn't really help Chrysler/Fiat.
Yeah, it actually does, because the Commander's a product with no future.
Well, it's going away.
Right.
If it's not gone already.
Yeah, so if it's stealing things from that, this is simply basically converging the Grand Cherokee and the Commander into a single, far better car.
It's just got to carry the company for the next...
Yeah.
Right. And getting Wrangler, because Wrangler has this ability to keep working.
Right.
You know, they added four doors to the Wrangler, and it recreated the vehicle. The other products right now are weak, and, you know, the next product that should get it is the Liberty, and you know that's a problematic vehicle for them as far as what they're going to do with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Pedro Fernandez says, Peter, stop playing so hard to get already and take the GM CEO job. You do better than all those bozos.
Well, you know, I would love to do it, but that's not going to happen.com.
Roger Will wants to know, does the new Sonata finally do away with the interference timing belt engines? I don't know.
Don't believe so. I don't think the 2-liter does.
What's that mean, interference timing belt engine?
I think it means they break.
Oh.
Yeah, that if you lose the timing belt, you have interference, you have piston to valve interference.
Oh.
So if the timing belt breaks, one of the valves will be down, and one of the pistons will, in fact, strike one of those valves, and that will cause...
A giant bowl of not good.
Yeah.
The engine is aluminum Wheaties now.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does the panel think of Top Gear America based on the trailer? I haven't seen the trailer.
I unfortunately did.
And you didn't like it.
It's not Top Gear.
It's not, you know, it's, you can't.
Why do we have to copy every British show?
I don't know, but you can't.
The British show's pretty good.
We'll try to. Anyway.
You can't recreate that show.
You can't recreate it on American commercial television. It is a physical impossibility. Because it's on the Beeb, they can say things and do things that won't offend a sponsor because the last I checked, there were no adverts on the Beeb. So, you know, and the truth is there are only a few people on earth that can be as curmudgeonly and outspoken as Clarkston, and I don't know who any of them are.
Right. Yeah. Chris, we got a question from you from Dave Hudgens. He wants to know, what are the chances of combining Transonic's fuel injection with Eco Motors? Savings of 75%?
Nope.
And that's a good
Maybe.
Question because, you know, Don Runkle's on both boards.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, why not? Things don't always add up like you might want them to, but it's an interesting proposition, yeah. Hmm.
If things did total up, you could put all the devices that J.C. Whitney said would give you 15% fuel economy, the car produced fuel. You know, the Burmese gas snake that ate the power-robbing red molecules, you put the snake in the tank and the electric turbocharger. But
well, I don't know why you guys don't get into car magnets. Because if you knew anything about engines,
oh, yeah.
you know that
oh,
they
yeah.
align the molecules in the gasoline.
The non-ferrous molecules are manipulated by a magnetic field. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I always liked in J.C. Whitney the little propeller kind of things that you would lift up the intake manifold.
In the induction system to cause a mini tornado in your engine.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I love J.C. Whitney. I got my set of headers for my Corvair from J.C. Whitney.
No kidding.
Yeah, they made.
So they did have good stuff.
They had performance parts?
Oh, yeah. They had the headers that you got for Corvairs.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Whoa. Hey, what's the panel think of the theoretical Buick Compact?
I'm beginning to wonder about GM. I mean, I know they have the ability to generate a lot of vehicles. But I hope they're careful because all of a sudden it'll be the same thing. Well, we've got compacts running into midsize, running across the divisions and then in the market. They better be careful with that.
If he means the theoretical Buick Compact, the Buick Delta product, you know, it's not theoretical. It's going to happen. And I can see the market for it for something more than a Cruise. It's the same platform, but they are radically different cars, lots of different tin. I can see a market for it. And the other thing is Buick has this opportunity to get a bunch of Gen Ys. Because the only time they get a Buick is if Grandpa gave them a hand-down car, because these guys' parents were driving Camrys and Accords.
Well, so, I get that, but the ability to differentiate.
That's it. It's critical in differentiation.
In the consumer's mind.
Yes.
Have you
seen the new Opel Astra, haven't you?
Yeah, yeah.
That is, in fact, the car. And you look at an Astra and a Cruise, and the truth is they're two different cars. The Astra is a car that actually walks closer to where the new Focus is.
Yeah.
And the Cruise doesn't. So in that respect, there could be a good space for it in a range.
Youngblood says, Peter, your subliminal messaging to Big Ed Whitaker appears to be working. He suggested that a Cadillac 16 concept-like vehicle should be the flagship for the brand. I wonder if a soft rubber mallet to the head would seal the deal.
Well, they are working on a flagship, so that's good.
And 007 Mitch W. says, would Jim Hall please tell us about the car movie he wants to produce?
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, we don't have all night.
We don't have time for it. But if we do a movie thing again, I'd love to do it, because there is a car movie I think they should do.
Actually, I thought I saw something else here. Oh, yeah. Somebody had written in saying which actors should play what thing. So Andre says, continue on that thought of Out of Line After Hours, the movie. Drew Carey portrays Jim Hall of 2953 Analytics, and Chow Yun-Fat can play James Jimmy Fu, co-chairman of Fu King Motors. Hey, let's get to some phone calls. Ben, let's bring in the first one.
I think Fu King Motors is going to be on my tombstone.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. You know, my question this week is, if GM does not have the resources to do the next Impala right with rear-wheel drive and make it really stylish, should they even bother at all? I've been reading some stuff on the Internet where it seems like GM might be leaning towards a front-wheel drive replacement for the Impala, and I think it's a waste of time. You know, in my opinion, if people need a bigger front-wheel drive sedan than the Malibu, then why not steer those buyers to a LaCrosse or something like that? See a lot too much overlap in the GM lines potentially. Thanks. Bye.
The problem is that the Wright Impala, from a volume standpoint, unfortunately, is a front-wheel drive car.
However,
yes,
there are going to be additional products that are rear-wheel drive.
Exactly. Absolutely correct. But so the idea of an Impala, because they yet understand the Impala at its peak years is knocking down 300,000 units recently off the previous platform.
It's still selling very well.
And the truth is, it is...
Like 42.5% of its fleet.
A lot. Well, or maybe more on that
maybe
one.
Maybe more.
But the truth is, if you want to do volume, the volume potential for a so-called large midsize car that's rear drive, including fleet, with an available all-wheel drive system in the market that we're probably going to be dealing in a I'll be generous and say a 14 to a 16 million unit market from General Motors is probably 165 to 180,000 units a year. Do it as front-wheel drive, you've doubled it, the potential, including fleet. And it's not the car I would want to own, but they can still do that rear-wheel drive car, especially with the Alpha platform now.
Yeah, and so there is going to be a high-performance Chevrolet.
Yeah, you just can't get hung up on the fact that names are names.
Yeah.
If the enthusiast that really knows would tell you that a Malibu, as nice as the Malibu is, now that's not a Malibu. I mean, a Malibu is a 1970 LS5, for gosh sakes. So don't get hung up on that. But the larger midsize car they need, especially because the next generation Malibu is getting smaller.
Yeah.
Okay,
not a lot,
Ben,
but it's getting smaller.
Let's bring in another phone call here.
Hey, guys. It's Nathan Keeley from Zanesville, Ohio. And I was wondering if anyone's heard any information on the progress of E15. How come we can blend 10% of ethanol in the gasoline and be okay, and we can blend 85% in the gasoline and be okay, but we can't do 15? I mean, is there something that we can't physically do, or is it more politics?
It's what you get out of it.
It's also politics.
Well, of course. Politics is always there. But the thing is that as you go from E10 to E15, there's a benefit, but it's not that big. And you're starting to get into the thing where you notice a decrease in total thermal energy, so fuel economy goes down.
Well, here's the real deal, though, is that we are awash in ethanol right now, but we're not selling enough E85.
Right.
There's plenty of vehicles that can run it, but we're not selling it. So, I mean, the blenders are really up to their ears right now in ethanol. That's why they want to go to E15. But the big three, especially, or anybody who makes flex fuel vehicles, gets massive CAFE credits.
For the high-end dilution. The high-end.
For the flex fuel that run on E85. Yeah. But the fear is, especially amongst the big three, none of which have voiced this, is if you go to E15 and now all cars have this benefit, they're going to take the CAFE credits away from having building flex fuel E85 cars. So the big three are saying, oh, we got to worry about snowblower engines and motorboat engines. And it's like, so anyway, there's a lot of politics in that. I think we will go to E15, and I think we'll see a decision maybe this year, certainly within a year. Anyway, Ben, let's bring in another one.
Hi, John. This is Os Rutherford from Greenville, South Carolina. And I just wanted to point something out to you about the Jaguar Land Rover profit that was announced a week ago. The question shouldn't be how much did Jaguar and Land Rover make. The question should be how much did Tata pour into them during that period of time. Because if they're doing the same thing like Ford did, then they're losing a ton of money still. All right. Thanks. Bye.
That's a great question. That's a great point.
Yeah.
That's a great. You know, look, Jaguar made some 370. Jaguar Land Rover made some $370 million in profits. Mm-hmm. I don't think Tata's putting a whole lot of money into the company just yet. That's one of the benefits of having bought it from Ford. Ford poured the billions of dollars into putting in a pretty good line.
The money they're putting in it, that Tata's putting in it now, is the global marketing money they've been putting in, and they're starting development on two new vehicles.
Right.
Yeah.
But to the viewer's point, yep, they are going to have to spend the same kind of money that Ford did, and that's when we're going to see the real test if Tata can really make something, yep, of Jaguar and Land Rover. And I would add, can Geely make anything with Volvo? Because once those guys have to start spending the billions, and remember, Ford's still supplying engines for Jaguar Land Rover.
Right.
Once they have to start developing them themselves, it's what, $1 billion, right? If you want an all-new engine and an all-new plant,
billion,
you're talking
billion and
a billion
and
easy. Easy.
Yep.
So, and that's on top of the other products. But anyway, great point.
Except with Geely, I'll say this. They have the ability then to take the Volvo brand and use it in China. And that's where there's some upside potential for them. So
clearly,
they might be able to make money with it. That's a luxury that Tata does not have, because if you decide to bring and create Jag as a volume brand in India, you're still not going to make a lot of money, or else you're going to have like a Jaguar Nano, the concept of which makes me want to go get Photoshop and start doing it up when I get home. This is a neat idea.
Ben, hey, let's keep them rolling.
If they can make an Aston Martin out of a Toyota IQ, you should be able to do a Jag off a Nano.
Right. I think we got another phone call there, Ben. Let's put
it in. Hey, guys. Good evening. It's Marty from Atlanta. Just wanted to say I just heard about the passing of Jerry Flint. It's sad news. He was the voice of reason and logic in a business populated by bombast and propaganda and buzzword guys. I'm going to miss him. Thanks.
Thanks for that thought. I'm going to miss him, too. Jerry was he was a gem. We lost a gem.
One of a kind.
What else do we have here? Actually, I think we've got a pretty good wrap-up of...
We have two more calls.
Chip, our producer here, has just said we've actually got two more calls that just came in for Chris, so we're going to take them.
It's Jim Campbell calling from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. With regards to your the fuel injection and all those kinds of things, you know, there's very little unburned fuel coming out of the tailpipes in today's automobiles. I'm thinking probably the best thing to do is probably is decreasing the prosthetic energy loss in engines and rolling resistance and weight and probably all the weight with safety equipment, those kinds of things. I think with regards to this new program that you guys are discussing in the show today is similar to some of the stuff we've seen over the years. Whenever there's an energy crisis, carburetors that would get 75 miles to the gallon back in the early 70s and 80s and those kinds of things. Anyway, thank you very much. Great show.
Huh?
Hey, guys. This is Youngblood calling in Cleveland, Ohio. This engineer from Transonic Combustion, his idea sounds very similar to what our beloved Smokey Unick used to have in the, I think it was the early 80s. He called it a hot vapor engine. I wonder if he'd like to comment as to whether he's aware of Smokey's original attempts and whether this might be just a 21st century adaptation with the electronics and everything else that's available now that Smokey didn't have. Hey, keep up the good show and have a good one. Bye.
Thanks. Good question. Are you familiar with Smokey's work?
I'm familiar with the Smokey Unick's concept. The major difference with this combustion system is that we are timing the combustion event, and that wasn't possible in those days.
Why? Electronics allows you to do it today?
Yeah, the electronic controls and advanced injection concepts like piezo-actuated injectors and 20 years ago, those weren't around, and so this is new stuff, and it's supported by the new technology. And
Sounds like Smokey was ahead of his times. He just didn't have some chips and piezo injectors. And
tough luck, Smokey.
That's great. Well, it's as I said before, probably. Good time to wrap this up. Remember, you can always follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/OutOfLine. You can always get Peter's stuff at autoextremist.com or twitter.com/autoextremist. Jim, you got a website or anything you want to push here?
Well, there's twitter.com/ I think it's Jim Hall 1, but I'm not sure because I don't contact myself that way anymore.
And then, Chris, I see your website is tscombustion.com. That's right.
Yeah,
and there's all kinds of information about
it's actually very detailed, and for the people that are interested, it provides a lot of information.
So, again, that's www.tscombustion.com, which stands for transonic combustion. Yeah. But Chris, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me. Enjoyed
keep an eye on this. Jim Hall, always having you.
Great to be here.
Back here. And Peter, yo, bro, good to have you here.
Good to be here, as always.
I got spurs that jingle, jingle.
Big Ed leaving.
As I go.
You guys gotta have a party. Give him a party at the end of the month.
Hey, don't forget, too, next week, Wednesday, not Thursday, Wednesday, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Woodward Dream Cruise. We will all be there.
Stars, cars, and babes.
You get a babes?
No.
Oh, dang.
Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Change of frequency.